listening to The Power to Make Change, a podcast with me, Kate Levine, talking to activists, campaigners, and changemakers about why, how, and what they do to make change in society. Today, I'm joined by Elizabeth Wathuti. Elizabeth is a Kenyan environmentalist and climate activist. She's the founder of the Green Generation Initiative, and she's head of campaigns at the Wangari Maathai Foundation. In a relatively short period of time, she's achieved a huge amount and has won a slew of really impressive awards. In 2016, she was awarded the fourth Wangari Maathai Scholarship. Professor Wangari Maathai was a social, environmental, and political activist and was the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Elizabeth also won the Green Climate Fund Youth Champion Award, and she's been named one of the 100 most influential young Africans by the Africa Youth Awards. As the founder of the Green Generation Initiative, she encourages young people to love nature and to be environmentally conscious from a young age. And through this initiative, she's planted 30,000 tree seedlings in Kenya, which have an impressive 98% survival rate. I'm so honoured to be joined here today by Elizabeth, who's joining us from Nairobi. Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for being here on the podcast. Really delighted to have you.
Thank you so much, Kate, for having me.
This is a really busy time in climate activism, not just right now at this day, but in 2021, we have had report after report after report, including a fairly recent report from the IPCC. We're heading into COP26. There is no time to waste in climate activism and environmentalism. Would you agree?
Totally. I think this is the time when we should be seeing more rapid action, because even as we receive these reports like the IPCC report, which was actually so shocking, people are still being impacted by the climate crisis. And there are people that have to deal with both the COVID-19 pandemic and the climate crisis. So we definitely don't have any time to waste to commitments or pledges or saying we're going to do this in the next 20 years. I think it's time to begin the rapid action now.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of talk, isn't there? A lot of rhetoric, but maybe not, definitely not enough action. COP26 is a time for action. How positive are you feeling? How optimistic are you feeling about the talks in November in 2021 in Glasgow, where the UK is hosting COP26 this year, which is the UN International Talks on Climate Change? Are you optimistic that action will be taken?
So I would say this is going to depend on what we'll begin to see from different countries and the world leaders, because right now there has been a lot of commitments coming from countries and governments. And while it sends a positive and a good signal to see countries committing to maybe net zero, but what we are saying is that 2050 commitments are not enough. We want to see what is changing and how those commitments are feeding into what governments are doing right now at the national level. And I think that is only what is going to help us begin to feel optimistic, because it feels as though our leaders right now are out of step with what people want. And I think recently there was a report where the G20 countries showed that lots of the people, about 83% of people, want to do much more to protect and regenerate nature, for example. So we want to really see a lot more from the leaders to begin to feel optimistic as well. And I think it's possible. And the other reason is right now we are seeing that nature is hitting back. Countries that did not experience, for example, flooding are now experiencing these things for the first time. And it's not even surprising that so many people now are realizing how close we are coming to terrifying tipping points, and they want to do much more to protect nature. So if we begin to see the same at COP26, you know, less of the commitments and more of rapid action, what is changing right now, what are governments doing, and how is that going to help us reach to that trajectory that we're talking about, like the years we're saying we want to begin seeing change. So it has to begin right now. And that's what is going to make me feel optimistic as a young person, if I begin to see rapid action taking place right now.
Yes, absolutely. And not only is rapid action necessary to tackle the worst effects of climate change, as you've just said, but I think there's something about taking action to so that you don't feel helpless. And I think as a young person, that must be particularly, well, must feel really overwhelming. I think that the world that you are living in and will live in for many years is, as you say, really close to a terrifying tipping point. If you're taking action, you feel like you're actually doing something about it. Would you say that's right?
Yes. There's the other side of optimism where, as a young person, I know that I am not alone in this fight. There are so many other young people from around the world who are doing lots of amazing things to tackle the climate crisis. They are not waiting for the politicians or the governments to take action. They're actually moving from their communities, from their countries, trying to make a change. And it's not only about voicing out, because one side of the activism is around voicing out and pushing for real urgent change from the politicians, from the government. But you can also see a huge amount of young people on the ground are the ones doing the real work that we talk about around nature regeneration, the real work on making sure that communities are able to adapt and mitigate climate change impacts. And I think this is what really gives us so much hope. At one time, I was asked in a webinar to close my eyes and reflect. And it was actually a webinar where we were discussing around the same storm, different boats by the Wangari Maathai Foundation. And we were saying, yes, while we may all be in the same storm, the climate crisis, we are definitely not in the same boats, because there are people that have a huge capacity to adapt and even more resources to adapt as compared to others. And I remember we were asked to just close our eyes and envision the kind of world we want to live in. How does it feel like? How does it smell like? What is it that we see? And I think I saw lots of things, like the green cities, trees all around the cities. I could see the clean streams and rivers flowing. I wanted a kind of a world where we are living in harmony with nature. And I thought to myself, I want to live in that kind of world. But then a few days back, I read another report that says that Nairobi, my city, will be uninhabitable in the next 50 years. So it shows us that there's a lot of things that can make us feel overwhelmed. And, you know, we feel like though things are moving backwards. But I think what keeps us optimistic is because of that world that I envisioned. I want to live in that world. So I cannot afford to give up and then live in a world that is uninhabitable. So it's all about pushing every other day to make sure that I live in that world that is habitable and that future that is livable. And I think this is why every young person is fighting today. That's what keeps us optimistic, that we want to live in that world that we all envision.
Yeah, that's you're so right. And it's I've spoken to quite a few activists, particularly on this podcast, but generally, who talk about the importance of having the ability to imagine and to have that vision, exactly what you've just talked about. So that's the thing that really drives you forward. And I suppose also maybe the connection with other young people. Are you in contact with other young activists, and does that help?
Yes, I'm in contact with so many other young people from my country, Kenya, and also young people from all around the world, because I think that solidarity is so important. If an activist friend of mine maybe reaches out to me from another country, I would want to support, because challenges happen in every country, and that's how we show solidarity to one another. And just like the other day, we came together with different activists from all around the world and sent out a youth activist report and statement around defending environmental defenders. And this was after we lost Joanna Stutchbury in Kenya, who was an environmental defender trying to protect and defend Karura Forest. And it shows us that some people are even willing to put their lives on the line to protect the environment. And what needs to be done is that our environmental defenders need to also be kept safe. And I think such a kind of statement where young people came together from around the world to support in sending out a statement saying we must defend the defenders if we have to win this war against the climate and ecological crisis. It shows that it actually works, like to have young people as a community working together, reaching out to one another when there's a challenge in your country and you can be able to support one another. So I think that's a report that would be great also for everyone to read. It was published by The Independent around defending environmental defenders. And also lots of cases of how many we have lost so far and why young people also begin to feel unsafe when such things happen in their countries, because we are in the same line. We are fighting for these spaces as well. And when we begin to lose other defenders, then it shows us that we are also not safe. So I think that solidarity and that oneness among the young environmental activists is really working. And it helps us also continue to be optimistic, knowing that we are not alone. There are others that are fighting with us and ready to support us.
Yes, absolutely. You've just said so much then that is incredibly important. And I think if you don't mind, I'm going to go back and unpick a little bit of it just for people who may not know about Joanna Stuchbury and what happened and then what you've done since then, because that was a pretty shocking piece of news that certainly got quite a lot of publicity in internationally. In the UK, I read reports in The Guardian and The Independent. So Joanna was a climate activist in Kenya, in Nairobi, with you. And can you explain what happened? Because when you said we lost her, maybe people didn't realize she was actually murdered, wasn't she?
Joanna Stuchbury was fighting to protect Kiambu Forest in Kenya. And this is a forest that has been degraded for over years. And she was trying to protect the only remaining bit that was left of that forest after all the degradation. And unfortunately, she was murdered. And she has been part of the different fights we've been doing around green spaces. And also part of the campaign and coalition called Daima that I coordinate. Daima is a coalition of civic actors who have all come together to advocate for the protection of urban green spaces in Kenya. And I remember the last time that Joanna also was in part of these Daima events was when we were trying to fight to protect 100-year-old iconic fig tree in Westlands in Nairobi, Kenya. And probably that is also something that people saw all around the news. So she was actually murdered, and she was only trying to keep all of us safe through protecting this space. And I think the message that needs to be sent out there is that environmental defenders are only trying to keep everyone safe. So we should be keeping them safe too. But this is not happening. And what we are seeing is a rising assassination as well of environmental defenders, which is the same case that happened to Joanna Stuchbury. And I think since then there has been lots of push in Kenya and beyond, people trying to organize different activities, vigils, memorials, tree planting in her memory, and also trying to push for the leaders to, give their statements as well in defense of environmental defenders. So all of these campaigns continue because since Joanna was murdered, justice has not been served yet.
So there's there been an official investigation into her murder?
So apparently there's not much being said about her murder yet. And what we've been seeing has been the hearings at the Senate. And I think the most recent one was postponed. So there's a delay. And I think justice delayed also is justice denied. So because she was murdered, it's almost over 2 months now, and we need to begin hearing are there people that are being questioned, what is going on, and all these updates. But there isn't much in sight yet. So we're really hoping that eventually justice is going to be served for Joanna and also for so many other environmental defenders that we have lost along the way, murdered in so many other parts of the world.
Yes, I have also read recently about situations like this taking place in the Amazon, in the Amazon forest too. So, and it's shocking. We know that climate change itself is a killer, something that we, mankind, humankind has created. But actually to hear about individuals literally being murdered by anti-environmentalists, as you say, the potential the forest has been degraded, and that degradation of the forest is actually taking place by human beings, by companies. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And I think one thing I would say Right now, as we speak, there will be people trying to stop encroachment caused by maybe ongoing developments in a primary forest or an urban green space somewhere. And even when these places and spaces are protected, there's still so much pressure of the competing demands. And in the process, our safety is not even guaranteed. And I think that is what ends up happening. And I think there is a huge disconnect between the people that are trying to actually halt nature destruction and the people that are actually, you know, in power, influential. How do we make sure that we really support these people? Because the problem is that the people that are on the front line protecting these spaces are under threat. And the only thing that we are armed with is extraordinary courage. I love to say that every time. So there's clearly no reason enough to live in fear or feel threatened, you know. And if anything, I think it also makes us a little bit more stronger and gives us a reason to keep fighting, because it shows that not everyone appreciates the work that we do. There are people that really are there to silence and make sure that we stop what we are doing for them to begin destroying the environment. And that is something we shouldn't and cannot allow. So I think at the end of the day, these are challenges that also continue to make us stronger and give us a reason as well to keep fighting. So it's my hope that we could once and for all defend environmental defenders and, you know, defend the defenders. I think that's really important, even in this fight, as you talk about the climate crisis, because we are not going to make any steps if we do not have defenders who are speaking up for nature. Nature will not speak for itself. Nature can only hit back, but there are people who are lending their voices for nature and lending their voices for people that are the most affected by the impacts of climate change. So it's just a matter of listening to them and defending them as well as they continue to defend all of us, because that's why this fight is really important.
So do you mind if we go right back to the beginning? And can you tell me how you got interested in nature and the environment? I'm assuming it was from quite a young age. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes, it was from a young age and also different factors. And one of them is the fact that I am one of these people who have grown up in a beautiful forest, like one of the most forested regions in Kenya. So I don't like, not really in the forest, but in
nearby.
A region that is the most forested, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think one of the really amazing features that I lived close to was this clean stream that is actually the fastest river in Africa. And it's mostly in some of our geography books, but the tour companies and brochures don't get to mention it a lot, but this is a stream that really I would spend my time there as a child and just watching the water flowing and, you know, listening to the birds. Sometimes nowadays you hardly listen to the birds because our ecosystems have been so much destroyed. So you hardly listen to the birds, you hardly see butterflies that I would see back then. But I think this is what gave me this strong connection with the natural world. And I remember getting an opportunity to also plant my first tree when I was 7. And it's a time when Professor Angara Mathai was also the Member of Parliament in my home region, because that's also her birthplace. So she was a great inspiration. And I say till date, she inspires me a lot. And when we planted these trees, I thought to myself, after some years, I would want to go back to that hill and that forest and see how our trees are doing. Maybe they're so huge grown. Maybe they're really huge trees that I want to spend time finding shade under. And I got there, but to my surprise, the hill and the forest was different from what it used to be when I was a child, because I found tree logs and tree stumps right at the entrance of that forest. So what this felt to me was, I really felt so angry. And at the same time, I think a sense of, you know, my heart was a bit broken at that time. Like, I could not understand why anybody would do that to such a beautiful ecosystem. And for me, that was also a turning point, because this anger also, in a way, developed a hunger for me to want to do something about problems like deforestation. How do we stop people from destroying such beautiful forests? How do we stop people from interfering with nature? And how do we make everybody love nature and make everybody understand that these resources are there to be conserved. So that's how I also decided to now get fully into climate activism and become an environmentalist. I also wanted to be an environmentalist by profession as well, by career. So I really knew this is the field that I want to be in, because that was just a natural call to action. I did not get anyone to give me a duty to telling me, hey, go protect this forest. It just came from deep within me. I felt overwhelmed and I felt greatly disturbed, and I wanted to do something about that problem. So I studied environmental studies and community development in the university, that's in Kenyatta University. And then I also founded Green Generation Initiative in 2016. And this was to nurture more young people to love nature and to be environmentally conscious at a young age. Because like you've heard from my story, there's that connection. There's the love for nature that makes you connected to nature. And in the process, you feel the pain of nature and you're just caused to take action naturally. You do not need anyone to ask you to go out there and fight for this space. So that is the kind of world that I also envision, where people are conscious of their surrounding and the environment. And that's exactly what I wanted to create through this initiative. And I think since then I've been able to grow over 30,000 tree seedlings, especially with school children here in Kenya. It's been a great process seeing how they love nature and how they love to grow the trees as well. And that's just been part of the different things I've been focusing on through the initiative.
That's amazing. So when you were describing how you felt as a young child going into the forest when you still could experience it very deeply, the butterflies, the birds, the stream, seeing the trees, that is extremely personal, wasn't it? So what you're talking about is developing that very personal connection between human beings and nature.
Yes, I was about to say, I think every time someone asks me, why are you fighting? I think I feel it's more personal.
Yeah.
I don't want to see anybody destroying a park, a forest. I don't want to find anyone cutting down trees. I don't want to find anyone throwing trash in the streams, because I feel that pain.
Yes.
So I think if everybody felt the pain of nature, and you know, the pain of nature is what now contributes to the impact that we human beings face, because we will litter the city today and tomorrow we will have to, you know, drive in cars that are sunk in water because the flood, the town is, the city is going to flood, for example. But we will be the ones who have caused that. And it's the same with climate change. We destroy nature and then nature is going to hit back. So if we do not feel the pain of nature, then we will feel the pain after the impacts begin to hit on us. And that is not the way we would wish to go as the human race. So it's really, I would say, personal, because I have that really strong connection with nature that I wish everybody else in the world shared.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a little bit more about the work that you're doing with school children and how you have been able to impart that feeling of that really strong connection with nature and to encourage children to feel that deep connection that you felt as a child.
So it has mostly been giving them a practical experience and making them understand that it is okay to feel overwhelmed about the challenges that are happening, but you cannot just stop at being overwhelmed. There is something that you can do. There's something that a five-year-old can do. There's something that a 20-year-old can do to be able to help out and tackle some of these problems. And so I would give a practical example of how we approach these. I would want a child to understand what a polluted river looks like and what they can do about it. So I will take these children, and that's myself and my team, to a stream that is actually polluted, for example, in Nairobi City. Mm-hmm. And they will be able to see what it looks like, because a lot of times we have this system where it's more of theory. They just hear that rivers get polluted, but how does a polluted river look like? How does it make me feel as a young person? So there's that connection. You know, they go to the stream, it's polluted, a really bad smell coming from the stream, plastic. It's like a river flowing with poison and plastic waste. And there is that feeling now. I know that a river is supposed to be colorless, for example, with no waste, but here it is. I'm close to a river. I cannot drink from this stream. How does that make me feel? Of course, you can tell if the children are feeling sad and asking, who did this? What can we do to help? And that exactly becomes the turning point of how we transform the mindsets of these children, because they are triggered. They feel sad about the state of the stream, but again, they want to help. So that's how we begin to now train them on the solutions. How can they use their voices? How can they begin to do little individual responsibilities and steps in their schools, in their homes, at a personal level? And that's how everything begins to change for them. So we are looking at changing mindsets and making them love nature and want to protect and fight for nature. So I think that was a really good practical example. And the other one, of course, is the tree. It's a symbol of the environment. It's a symbol of nature. And having a child growing a tree from a seed and seeing it mature all the way, it really educates them not just about the value of that tree, but also it educates them about the value of life, you know, life in plants and all that. And they are able to become like plant parents as well. They can take care of that plant and get people to not cut down trees also, and they can use their voices because they have grown knowing what that plant looks like. And I think the other thing has been around greening schools. There are schools we go to and the children do not have anything that they can connect to nature with. There are no trees, there are no flowers. There is nothing that maybe they can say, we love this conducive environment. They're only used to the place maybe where there's no grass to sit on and there's no single tree in the compound. So when we get there and transform and change the face, like establish green fences, establish a food forest where it's a designated corner in the school compound and you plant mixed species of fruit trees, then that also solves the food insecurity issue and the school begins to have a beautiful look that the children will love. And I think in the process, that's how they begin to understand what's supposed to happen and how they should treat nature. And lastly, I think we also do a lot on establishing the environmental clubs in schools because we want these children to be nurtured along the way. It shouldn't be like a one-day event or activity and then we say that we've impacted them. No, it should be a process where you work with them, make them understand what climate change is, what can they do as young people, how is the world going to look like in 20 years, but what can they do to stop for example, I gave the prediction we have about Nairobi being uninhabitable in 50 years, but what can children do as well to reverse that report, you know, to make sure that by 2050, for example, or in the next 50 years, it's actually going to still be habitable. So it has to begin right now and making them understand that they can do something. Like, yes, they can do little actions, but they should not feel as though the actions are too little. They should feel as though their small acts multiplied by millions of other children can actually end up impacting the world.
Yes, that's such important work. And I suppose also you're bringing many teachers along with you too. So while your focus is, I think, rightly on the children, you must, when you're establishing the eco clubs and the ways to bring the children along and continue educating them, you have teachers there within the schools who are supporting and enthusiastic?
Yes, totally. Because we want to also make sure that there's an ownership from the school. If I'm not there, a teacher is there with the students and they know what to do with them next in terms of the experience in conservation. So we do not want to make it like we have to be there for them to continue being nurtured, but we also involve the teachers' training whereby they also understand what it is that we are doing and how can they support the children? How can they continue to really make sure that the projects are thriving? And one of the steps we do is make sure that when we get the clubs, we get a patron who is a teacher in the school.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
At the end of the day, he or she becomes our contact person and it becomes easier to also continue engaging the students.
Yes, that's brilliant. So the patron is sort of sponsors the whole program and continues its growth.
Yes.
As well as you were just talking about that frightening report saying that Nairobi could become uninhabitable. What kind of effects of climate change are you and everyone who lives in Nairobi are now experiencing there? What are you having extreme weather? What's it feel like?
Right now, there has been lots of climate change related impacts and challenges. And I think the most recent ones have been around the extreme weather conditions that have led to mudslides, landslides, and floods as well.
Yeah.
And right now, the president also just declared drought as a national disaster because there are places where, you know, there's so much drought right now and people have to stay without food as well. So I think all of these challenges have been there for quite a period of time. And the fact that now we are in the middle of a pandemic, most people still are struggling to get an income because I think with the lockdowns and places such as restaurants, for example, having to be shut down and or rather having limited time to operate, then it means that there are people who have also continued to lose their jobs at the same time. So, and being the fact that it's not really conducive right now, and you know, the challenges with climate change and the fact that people have to deal with all of these challenges is really a huge, huge problem. And I think also mostly in the cities, people can also feel like, you know, the heat waves, and it's I think the heat urban island, and it's a lot of challenge to really feel the fact that it's not the same anymore. And I think right now when someone gets into the city, everybody just wants to be out of the city. Like you just go in and you just want to go back to where you're coming from because you can feel that it's different. You know, there's so many cars, traffic congestion, and so much pollution. The air quality is not really good. So it's a problem because in the climate change conversations, I think many of the times you haven't really focused on the role of cities because, and even in the pandemic, the cities are the ones where, you know, there's like a super spreader. Lots of the cases are in the cities.
Yes.
So it is in these same cities where we can either win or lose the war against even the climate crisis. So we have to make sure that our cities are green, clean, and resilient at the same time. So it's a really important conversation that I would hope to also begin seeing in the COP26, you know, walls and, you know, what are we doing to green, clean and make our cities resilient? Because it's a huge problem.
Yeah.
Because lots of developments are coming up, roads expansions, you know, buildings, all of these things. But how are they ending up incorporating the green spaces to make sure that the city's trees, for example, remain intact, and to make sure that it's not about buildings and more concrete. It's about more of green and less of the concrete. Because at the end of the day, what we are doing, for example, I'll give an example with Nairobi, we are seeing lots of developments, but the big problem is most of these developments are centered around making more room for cars and not the majority of people that have to either walk or cycle or use public transportation. And that's the green space and point where we need to get. We need to get to the unmotorized transportation as well and make it safe for everyone. So how can development be green? You know, it's not just about saying, we are not just saying plant trees. We are saying, let us invest in the right projects that will also have less impact on carbon emissions. And I think that would be a really great thing to also make Nairobi habitable in the next years. And I think it's not just Nairobi. So many cities right now are having those challenges. There's lots of development that are threatening the limited existing green spaces.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's the case probably in almost every city that I can think of. It's certainly the case in London. But there are, you know, cities around the world where it is so much more intense, as you were saying, and the heat and the pollution is very intense and really has a massive impact on people's lives, doesn't it?
Totally.
So I'm going to ask you a question that's maybe a bit more personal now. And what does it mean? You're intimately connected with the Wangari Maathai Foundation, and you were also given an award by that foundation too. What does that mean to you personally?
I would mention the foundation, actually, the Wangari Maathai Foundation focuses a lot on instilling in the character traits of Papisa Wangari Maathai into young people. And that is part of the work that I'm really glad to be involved in, like lots of projects. And I think I have just highlighted one of them, and that is the program on the Daima Coalition for Green Spaces Protection that the foundation is a part of and actually leading and housing this coalition. So it is a really great legacy foundation that is really trying to show us that the same inspiration that I drew from Prof. Sangare Mathai, so many other people can be able to draw from that inspiration and begin to be impacted and skills with what they need right now to feel empowered, to feel that they can carry on with the activism, they can carry on to be change makers in society. And like one of the traits is courageous leadership. That is one of the things that Prof. Sangare Mathai really had. And it's a trait that I think every person would need to have, because right now a lot of things are happening and I think people are saying it needs thick skin to be able to really be on the front line and not feel overwhelmed or shaken by the challenges and really continue to fight on. And I think this is really important for me because it's building me as a young person, you know, with this courage, drawing all these inspirations from Sangare Mathai, working with other young people as well, to be able to see what does this look like? How do we continue to keep Prof. Sangare Mathai's legacy alive in young people? And I think it has really been an important process. And one of the things that the foundation has been focusing on, and the most recent one, is holding like youth cafes with young people towards COP26. And I think we had like an aligned 3 series of a youth cafe workshop, and the very first one was around youth and nature and COP26. Like, how do we make sure that young people understand the COP26 process, and how does that connect with the nature? Why is nature important to the COP26 conversations, and what role can young people play? So it's around building that courageous leadership in young people. And I think this has really been so much important and continue to shape me also as a climate activist and an environmentalist, and also giving me that platform to also empower other young people and reach out to other young people so that they can also feel, you know, really part of the process. Because at the end of the day, we are trying to push for genuine and meaningful youth engagement that is going beyond tokenism. It's about making sure that young people understand their place and make them and help them find their voices, and then make sure that the world is not just hearing young people speak, but it's actually listening to them and doing something about what is it that they're trying to bring at the table. So it has really been a great process, and Prof. Sangare Mathai has always been an inspiration, like I mentioned. And one of the things I always wanted as a young person was to meet her in person and like have a conversation with her, plant trees with her. But unfortunately, that did not come to happen, because at a time when I was studying so hard to meet her, because that is what my grandmother told me, if you want to meet Prof, you have to study so hard, because she was not just an ordinary person. She really did so much, and she became the first woman in Eastern Central Africa to earn a doctorate. So you really need to work so hard and you'll be able to meet her. So that was my motivation. But what I continue to do right now is to continue to draw lots of inspirations from her books. And one of my favorite is Unbowed, which really inspires me so much. And I would hope that everyone reads Unbowed by Prof. Sangare Mathai. It's a great, great book.
Yeah, that's so inspiring to hear, Elizabeth. And you've been inspired by her from the very beginning and continue to be inspired by her. I mean, I was really excited to hear that you were so connected with Wangari Mathai as well, because my children learn about her in school. When in primary school in the UK, that's part of the curriculum. So her word is being heard across the world, which is exciting. And it's so amazing that you're taking forward her ideas of courageous leadership and all of the work that you've done. I think it's wonderful to keep that spirit and hope and action alive. I think just coming back to the point about connecting with young people and making sure that your voices are heard. You really, people talk about you being, young people being the future, but you're the present, aren't you? It's now. Politicians of all ages people who are making policy, people who are making changes. We have to listen to you, don't we?
Absolutely, because at the end of the day, the decisions we are making today, we are the ones who will have to live longer with those consequences. And we have a right, and we need to be given that space to shape the kind of future that we want to live in. Because it will not make any sense if young people are ignored today, and in the next 50 or so years, we are the ones who will have to live in the kind of world that will have been created today without us and without our voices and without our ideas in the conversation. And I think that is why so many young people are pushing today. We do not want to live in a planet or, you know, in a world that is not habitable. We want to live in a space that we can actually be proud of, and we want to shape and be part of creating and co-creating that vision and that kind of world that we want to live in. And my hope is every young person can be listened to, because it's really important that we listen to the young people. We are so overwhelmed, like, by the challenges that are happening right now. And we are trying to make a difference. We are trying to collectively make a change. And the most important thing would be to involve us in the whole process. Listen to us and let us be there at the tables where these decisions are being made. And then we need to really feel a part of the process, because I think anything that is being decided for us without us is like against us. And that is why lots of young people are, you know, in the process, and they're also taking so much action. And I think we like to say that we are action. We are an action-oriented group. So when we are on the table, then things are going to begin moving. Because right now, and that's why you can see young people are taking action and pushing for the leaders to take action, but there's still action happening among the young people. So it tells you that this is an action-oriented young group. And that is why we do not want to hear pledges, commitments, and all that without real action. We want to see how we can move from commitments to action.
Well said. And I think there's so much hope for the future when we hear young people like you taking leadership, this courageous leadership, and the kind of action that you are 100% pushing for. So I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for joining me. I think that was an amazing, amazing work that you are doing, you continue to do, and all the very best for the future, for changing the world into the kind of place that we want to live in.
Thank you so much, Kate. That was a wonderful conversation, and thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Power to Make Change, a podcast about activism, campaigning, and making change. You can find it anywhere you usually get your podcasts. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe and tell your friends. I look forward to having you here to listen again.